Okay, this is Cameron McCune and Bob Dobbs again, and this is our 34th episode, and we're picking up from the Jean Baudrillard article, which we concentrated on last episode, and going to start to talk about what I say in my commentary, see where that leads Cameron. So I say, put in McLuhan terms, Jean Baudrillard is talking about visual space in quotes, which creates a fragmented print-defined separation between words. If someone is talking to you, they're slurring and blabbing away. No punctuation. But when you start punctuating and separating words into grammar based on visual book rules, that is a situation that leads to more hypotheses and separations between ideas. Down in the fourth paragraph, Baudrillard says, the whole traditional mode of causality, unquote. Remember, literacy brings in causality, and it's being brought into question by the new situation. Not the electric environment, but later technology, basically genetic and computer patterning, medicine, chemistry, analyzing DNA models. That's the new world of post-literate, post-fragmented simulation. That's Baudrillard's term, simulation. He's reading scientific journals and using their terms, whereas McLuhan used his own terms to talk about the new. Look at the list, quoting Baudrillard, the whole traditional mode. Look at the divisions, the active critical mode, the analytical mode, which actually thinks in terms of causality. There are determining molecules, and there's a perspective. It's all visual space, as McLuhan defines it. However,
right. So let's just stop there for a minute.
Yeah.
So as we were saying when we were looking at the Baudrillard long quotation, the Baudrillard is trying to think himself out of a problem. And that problem basically is visual space.
Yeah.
And the if visual space is sliced and diced and re-sliced and re-diced, it can never be got out of. So the problem that Baudrillard is going to have is that if he wants to go deeper and deeper and deeper into visual space, including getting into all of these scientific terms and new science and all that sort of stuff, all he does is get himself deeper into his problem.
Yep.
So the whole question that is posed by Baudrillard is, how does he start again? How does he get to a different starting place where the benefits and the achievements of visual space can be preserved, but the problems of visual space can be dissolved in some way?
And he goes on to think he gets out of the cul-de-sac.
Well, not in the piece that we read.
No.
I'd be very interested to know how he thinks that happens. And maybe we could, at some point, we could carefully go through what his answer or his proposal would be.
Yeah, I think it's in Simulacra and Simulations, early 80s book.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to pull out and find a quote or two. But anyways... Uh-huh. I carry on saying, however, in the new situation, the distinction is between the scientific print-created categories, cause and effect, active and passive, subject and object, ends and means. These are all from Baudrillard. All these dialectics. Then Baudrillard says, it is in this mode that it could be said, in the old way of visually biased people, does he put McLuhan in brackets? I guess. TV watches us. TV alienates us. TV manipulates us. TV informs us. And that leads to the paranoia of the electronic man, because they're putting a literate, fragmented view on a different kind of process that's going on that people don't see. And then Baudrillard says, throughout all this, one is dependent on the analytical or visual space conception. That's what I add. And then he says, whose vanishing point is the horizon between reality and meaning? End of quote. Then I say, the vanishing point was created by literacy, that's perspective, the artistic renaissance in Florence. Then Baudrillard says, well, I take Baudrillard's words, the horizon between reality and meaning. Then I say, literate people ask, well, what's real and what's meaningful? Then I say, you've got these dialectics, these splits. Baudrillard's inventorying the splits, and he's going to say, quote, none of this applies to where we are today. And that's totally McLuhan, I say. McLuhan is saying the same thing. But McLuhan is talking in the 50s and 60s, like the very first quote I offered. And Baudrillard, a younger academic in Paris, is reading science, and he's looking at the technology of genetic engineering on its own terms and seeing how it's different. Then I go say, now, back to the top, the famous book on the spectacle by Guy Debord, one of the situationists, whose newsletter in the late 60s Baudrillard had edited for these semi-beatnik guys running around doing the May 68 rebellion and other artistic performance art. They were called situationists. That whole thing that they were looking at and objecting to, society as a movie, television spectacle, was not relevant to the late 70s when the quotation above by Baudrillard is being written. Guy Debord is obsolete. That's what I think Baudrillard realizes. There was the first reality TV show in 1973. Somebody got the brainstorm, quote, let's just film this California family in their daily life, unquote. And it turned out to be a big hit. And one of the Louds family's kids was gay, Lance Loud. He went on to become a New York scene maker in the 70s because he was made famous by this reality show about his family. And Baudrillard says, in the case of the Louds, television is no longer a spectacular medium, unquote. The Louds represent the post-spectacular because television has changed. We are no longer in the society of spectacle, which the situation has talked about in the 60s, nor are we experiencing, quote, from Baudrillard, the specific types of alienation and repression which this implied, i.e. Big Brother or imperialism. All those literate Marxist objections to capitalism or imperialism led to alienation and the idea you're being repressed, which the black people, as a meme today, are being urged to think they're subject to. That's Black Lives Matter. I'm jumping forward to that. But 40 years ago, that stopped being the case. Baudrillard is pointing out, now I would think McLuhan was trying to get to this point when he said satellite Earth, what was it, he called the Earth Bucky Fuller's beach ball or something, spaceship Earth, whatever. He said there's no passengers, only crew. Everybody's creating the vortex. So there's not so much repression. So that's what I see McLuhan pointing out that Baudrillard is trying to get to. And so Baudrillard is pointing out that if you look at a medium and you read McLuhan, you think this medium, TV, is watching you. That's the way it was when you were literate in the 1560s, but not in the 70s. TV is not watching you. It's not even a separate medium. It's integrated into the flow of the global theater, where you can't tell how it's separate from another medium. Maybe I should say how it's separated from another medium. It's the beginning of the electronic cable TV reality. You have the merging of the medium and the message. And Baudrillard says that's McLuhan and writes, quote, it is the first great formula of this new age. Now,
let's just stop there for a minute.
Yeah.
I've been rereading Harold Innes.
Yes.
And Harold Innes, in his own sort of very Canadian, very Scottish, very practical fashion, was very concerned with ideas like this. But one of the things he does that's very interesting is he shows that these ideas that we're talking about now in the, let's say, the 1970s for McLuhan and 1980s for Baudrillard, were already seen in the early 19th century in England. People were already saying that it's not the case that politics are parodied on the stage. Instead, politics are staged, and we're all involved in this staging, which is taking over life. That was already seen by intellectuals in the 1830s. So then,
who's an example of that?
he quotes Bulwer.
Or Lotrima?
No. These are
British.
Innes isn't very interested in continental thought.
Oh, this is Innes quoting. Innes is quoting, not McLuhan. Okay.
So, yeah. This is Innes showing that, and you know, Innes was not. First off, he died in 1952.
Yeah.
So, you know, he certainly wasn't aware of debates going on 20 and 30 years later. However, the issues were already before him, and they were before him in terms of what 19th century British intellectuals already saw going on in society. So it seems to me we have two things going on here between Baudrillard and McLuhan. One is, what are the problems, put it another way, what is happening to society when the world becomes a global village? You can describe that happening in many different ways. And then you can ask, well, what does that imply? Where do you get to in the global village? And the answer to that is implosion. The answer to that is you don't get anywhere because things ultimately merge, and with the merger, you lose reality and you lose meaning.
Now, right. Now who's Bulwer you're quoting in this quote? How do you spell that?
He was B-U-L-W-E-R.
Bulwer, okay.
Yeah.
And he
yeah.
quotes him.
Yeah, well, Innes is practically only quotes, and it's quite amazing. So political economy and in the modern state, he has long essays which are about 90% quotations from other people. To my mind, it's the kind of model for Gutenberg Galaxy. It's often hard in Innes to know when it's Innes talking or when he's quoting somebody. And the same thing is true in Gutenberg Galaxy. There are unacknowledged quotations which just sort of go on from what McLuhan is talking about. And then it turns out that he hasn't been speaking in his own voice at all. He's been just citing somebody else.
Mm.
And that's something that you find in Innes and spades.
Okay.
It's really not. Go ahead.
You talk about the 1830s. This is where I start my LaRue Squadron, 1840. That's the global village.
Well, you're prescient, Bob.
Yes, I anticipated Innes in retrospect.
That's a good line.
Yeah, I hadn't known that this was what I was referring to. You're saying that Bulwer, he's quoting Bulwer in the 1830s? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And but not exclusively Bulwer. The quotations that he makes are astonishing. I wrote a post that gives some of his quotations. I don't know if you're interested to reference that at some point, but the post is called McLuhan Reads Innes's Political Economy in the Modern State, Number One. And basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through Political Economy in Modern State, and I'm going to show how there's an astonishing number of ideas in Innes that I don't say were found by McLuhan for the first time in his life, but either they were new to McLuhan and interested him, or they reinforced ideas he had from someplace else. So just as an example, one of the...
Well, when did Innes write this collection?
Some of the essays are from the 1930s, but most of them are from the 1940s.
Yeah, before Empire and Communications and the bias of communication. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
All right, that's good. Okay, yeah, read a couple.
Yeah, so, for example, here's a man by the name of Bagehot. I don't know how to, if that's the correct pronunciation of his name, but it's B-A-G-E-H-O-T, Walter Bagehot.
I've seen
he
that
wrote
name.
So he wrote a article on Charles Dickens already in 1858, and what he says is, this is Innes. Innes says, London was like a newspaper, right? So, and then he quotes Bagehot, everything is there and everything is disconnected.
So, that's the quote from Bagehot.
That's right. So this is Innes citing people from the 1850s in England, and he's saying, look, certain problems are already apparent here in the 1850s that will be developed by the symbolists in French poetry, starting around that same time with Baudelaire and going to the end of the century with Mallarmé. So McLuhan, 5 years after this 1946 book by Innes, is saying that modern art is like a newspaper, and he writes all kinds of essays on that topic.
Yeah.
So then here's something else from Innes. This is Innes himself.
Yeah.
He says the London stage at that point, and the London stage was used to appeal to the eye rather than to the ear. I mean, this is incredible stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Then another quotation. He says, spectacles were the fashion. At present, and this is a quotation citing Bulwer from 1833, at present, the English, instead of finding politics in the stage, find their stage in politics, right? So that's the Global Village, the Global Theater in 1833.
You know, this may be the guys I told you about, the eye-ear ideologues. Let me go to my library and see if Bagehot, that may be where I've seen the book, by this Vincent somebody, he was a student of McLuhan and ended up teaching in the States. I was telling you about him, you know, many months ago.
Yeah.
The eye-ear thing was in there in the middle of the 19th century. So let's see what this is. Vincent. Where is he?
Yeah, I know who you're talking about, but I can't remember his last name either.
Yeah, Vincent. Huge library here. Huge. Vincent, come on. Where are you? Keep talking while I look.
All right. So I guess what I would say is that about where we are in the book is that the attempt to go into the practicalities of life in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, 2000 is interesting in the sense that if McLuhan really were outside of the cul-de-sac, then we need to be able to find in him a good analysis of these happenings that occurred after he died.
Yeah.
So
is Innes you're talking about?
No, I'm talking, well, I mean, it applies to Innes, but I'm speaking specifically of McLuhan. What I'm saying is if somebody like McLuhan or indeed somebody like Innes had a way of looking at life, looking at reality that was not disabled by Gutenberg perspective, then one of the tests that we need to bring to that is how that understanding can be applied to things that happened after they were dead. And I think that's one way of looking at what you're doing in the book at this point. You're following Baudrillard into practical reality after McLuhan was already passed away.
Yes. The guy's name is Vincent Cherry. I've got one book, but it's not the one I'm looking for. Sorry.
Did he write stuff on the generation of the First World War?
Yeah, he wrote on
the men of 1914 or whatever.
Yeah. So, where are these books? Don't know why I can't see them.
So are you looking for books, and then within the books you can
see if a bag of hot. Yeah, I'm looking for his particular book, first one I read, and I got to keep looking to find it.
Uh huh. But you can't make a search across books.
What did you say? Across.
I say, can you across? In other words, I guess
if you find
a book. Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, it's called Ezra Pound, Wyndham Lewis, and Radical Modernism. And it came out in 93. So I'm going to go into the back and see if Bagehot is listed.
Mm-hmm.
No Bagehot.
So are you looking at an electronic version of the book?
No,
are you looking
hardcover.
No. Oh, I see.
And so he's talking... see where he first gets from the continent to England, 1889 to 1925. Okay, as the terror subsided in post-revolutionary Paris, that's 1871, liberal intellectuals named Marie-Jean Condorcet, Emmanuel Cise, and Antoine de Stutt de Tracy, I've only heard of Condorcet, found themselves allied in a well-founded skepticism about the practical validity of the new political ideals. Liberty and equality and fraternity, urgent but nonetheless abstract notions, had manifestly failed to guide civil behavior in the desired direction. So this is about like 100 years later. And so this loose confederacy of thinkers, members of the class of moral and political sciences at the newly formed Institute of France, sought to return social thinking to an older Enlightenment tradition. Empirical inquiry into human physiology, in particular the faculties of perception and cognition, and not the reiteration of preconceived ideas, must provide the concepts to guide self-government. On this exercise, they conferred a name that locates a prime irony of intellectual history. The name is ideology, ideologie. You know, it's French. For the usual modern sense of this term, hyphen, a body of political beliefs enjoying the unquestioned allegiance of a fideist, defies the first intent of ideology, or that's hyphenated, intent of ideology, as expressed in the Greek roots of the word. Most precisely, a study of images, or eidos, E-I-D-O-S, which means image. More broadly, an objective analysis of the social meaning of sense impressions. LaRouche would say they went Aristotelian. Following John Locke and Abbé Condillac, and regarding ideas merely as the transformed stuff of sensation, the first ideologues, isn't that interesting? This is how the word was first said. The first ideologues took the fabric of sentient and perceptual life as the sole locus from which political and philosophical concepts could be adduced. An abstract hypothesis must be founded on an objective basis. That's concepts coming from percepts. The right to property discovered a rationale that fairly samples their method. Let me just jump ahead here. Now, we know McLuhan talks about Benda. So he says here, news of the French movement reached England by 1797 when the monthly magazine carried notice of Tracy's explanation of ideology. Yet its main tradition remained on the continent, where Anglo-Americans of European leanings, T.E. Hume, as well as Pound and Lewis, could find the Enlightenment legacy, which was rekindled at the turn of the next century. Sociology.
You said 1797.
Yeah.
It must have meant 1897.
No. Yes, it's, but he's saying 1797. Let me look at footnote 3.
Yeah, I think it must be a misprint in the book.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound right.
That's right. Let's see. Chapter 1, footnote 3. You know, he's got here monthly magazine, 3rd of April, 1797. Doesn't seem to be that early.
That was immediately after the French Revolution.
Yeah.
Well, he may be saying that the English got the news of, these
of the revolutions.
No, the English knew about the French Revolution very, very quickly. That was not a problem. But the idea that the ideologues are going back to the previous century, which is what you were reading about, maybe that's what he's talking about. Maybe that's the news that came to people like Hume.
Yeah, because he's quoting Tracy from 1817. So, yeah, there's a little screw-up here. I'm seeing it. I thought it was more in the 1850s when this became popular. But anyways, he says Hume, as well as Pound and Lewis, could find the Enlightenment legacy, which was rekindled at the turn of the next century. So that's 1910. Sociologists were once again addressing the material basis of human sensibility, as were estheticians like Gourmand, René Gourmand and Benda. The tradition they were extending, however, had complicated itself during the preceding century. While the original ideologues belonged to a progressive intelligentsia, eager to consolidate revolutionary gains by proving egalitarian ideas empirically, so maybe, 1797, their scientific approach played into the reactionary hands of Henri Saint-Simon and Auguste Comte in the mid-19th century. So now he's jumped 50 years. The earlier emphasis on common physiology was shifting to stress on variable human nature, to describe an ideally hierarchical, organic social order, a natural elite. Heirs to this double tradition, the modern critics of literature and painting align their cessations with various social creeds opposite political testaments. As such, the Europeans demonstrate not only the flexibility of a living tradition, but the free, open-ended, essentially inductive character of their method. Their civics varied according to the different laws they saw evidence in the human senses. Now, most attempts to return social precepts to the ways of the Soma, Terry Eagleton, he's a 70s guy, argues forcefully in the ideology of the aesthetic, represent an enterprise designed to ratify the concepts of the existing political order. Okay, so remember how McLuhan talked about theater lips? This is, he's mentioned here, in romantic and post-romantic poetics, no experience figures more largely than the act of empathy. From the landscape conventions of the late 18th century through the dramatic monologues of the Victorians, a primary motive and goal for poet and reader is to achieve union with the aesthetic object. Modern commentators tend to present this feeling of identification as a strictly physiological moment in a kind of descriptive mechanics. Waringer, who McLuhan talked about, quote, "To enjoy aesthetically means to enjoy myself in a sensuous object diverse from myself," Waringer argues in Abstraction and Empathy. "To empathize myself into it. The mainspring of his projection lies in his inner vitalist core. This energy called, quote, life, inner working striving by his forerunner, Theater Lips, wells up, and its surge carries its possessor into a feeling of contact with nature or objects close by. Thus, the percipient may flow uninhibitedly with his inner feeling of vitality, with his inner need for activity, into the cognate organic. So this is all leading into Bergson, who gets into empathy, and that's aligned with the ear. And then you have the eye. But I'm looking for Bhagavat, and he's not in here. So Bhagavat may be part of this world, though. And that's the eye-ear thing becomes, by the mid-19th century, factional. So I'm thinking that's what Bulwer or whoever you're quoting is getting it from, and Innes is getting it from. Okay? So Vincent Cherry, you might want to look into him sometime.
For sure. But what's going on here, in my view, Bob, is that the 19th century, like any century, can be seen in terms of the dynamics of the relation between ear and eye, or the dynamics between form and matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I see going on here is people trying to think how these dynamics can be conceived in a way that provides access to what's going on, and especially access to how to avoid extremes in society and how to maintain ideals in society.
Yeah.
And so people start in France, let's say. First, there is an extreme emphasis on ideas, fraternity and equality, for example. And now these people in 1870, after the experience of the 19th century before them, say, well, look, this concentration on ideas didn't lead to stability at all.
Yeah.
It led to too much emphasis on revolution, then too much emphasis on stability, and it really never got us anywhere. So what we have to do is we have to try to bring ideas into relation with soma, with the body.
Yeah.
The analysis is, well, there was too much Platonism, we need more Aristotelianism.
Yeah.
But the problem that's going on here, and one that we all saw in Baudrillard, is that no matter how you play with these oppositions, all you do is get more firmly entrenched in them. And so the big question is, how do we get into a place where we can more or less look back on these oppositions at least not be trapped by them, and that this ideal in relationship to the oppositions becomes a kind of motor to modern intellectual history.
Yeah. Now, Bhagavat, the reason Innes would know about him, he's a journalist and businessman who wrote extensively about government and economics. Okay, so says that he wrote a book in 1872 called Physics and Politics, in which he examines how civilizations sustain themselves, arguing that in their earliest phase, civilizations are very much in opposition to the values of modern liberalism, insofar as they are sustained by conformism and military success. But once they are secured, it is possible for them to mature into systems which allow for greater diversity and freedom. His viewpoint was based on a distinction between the qualities of an accomplished man and those of a rude man, which he considered the result of iterative inheritances by which the nervous organization of the individual became increasingly refined through the generation. He regarded this distinction as a moral achievement, whereby through the action of the will, this accomplished elite was able to morally differentiate themselves from rude men by hereditary drill.
Mm-hmm. Number one, at the same time as the French people were looking for some sort of connection between ideas and the body, and he seems to be talking about the same thing,
yeah.
Doesn't come to the same conclusions. But I think what you may be talking about here is not the Bulwer that Innes was quoting from 1833, but his son.
No, this is Bagehot. I'm quoting Bagehot.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought
it was Bagehot.
Oh, okay, Bagehot, yeah. Walter Bagehot.
Right, so now if I put in mm-hmm. Bulwer, let's see what they say about him. Bulwer, this would be 1801 to 1872, British politician, diplomat, and writer probably, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Henry Bulwer. Political person.
Henry Bulwer doesn't sound right. Let me try and find out.
He was a writer. British politician, English physician and writer, John Bolton. No, that's 1606. Nephew of Henry Bulwer. I think it might be. Unless it's James Bulwer.
I'll have the answer in a minute.
Okay.
His name was Edward Lytton Bulwer.
Mm.
Lytton is spelled Lytton.
Yeah, that's Edward, this guy.
Okay, good.
It says William Henry Lytton, Earl Bulwer. It's got Lytton, so maybe was the elder brother. Okay. Bulwer, Edward Bulwer Lytton, is the brother of the guy I'm talking about. So
good.
I'll click on that guy. He was a writer and politician, too. Let's see what they say about his ideas.
Yeah, the Bulwer family was active throughout the 19th century in England. And if memory serves, the last one was involved in a very scandalous life with, I can't remember if he had several wives at the same time. But
would that be Edward?
No. This is two or three generations later.
This guy is quite encyclopedic. So Edward,
he
began in 1820 with a book of poems. He wrote in a variety of genres, including historical fiction, mystery, romance, the occult, and science fiction.
Yeah.
He financed his extravagant way of life with a varied and prolific literary output, sometimes publishing anonymously. So pretty interesting character.
Yep. Innes quotes from a book called England and the English. He quotes a lot from it. And one amazing quotation from Bulwer in 1833 is the following. He says, "The magic of Gutenberg conjured a wide chasm between the past and future history of mankind. The people on one side of the gulf are not the same people as on the other side."
Wow, now
that's incredible, right?
Yes, and I know who this Bulwer Lytton is. He's in the conspiracy literature. Listen to this. He wrote many other works, including Vril, V-R-I-L, The Power of the Coming Race, 1871, which drew heavily on his interest in the occult and contributed to the early growth of the science fiction genre. Its story of a subterranean race waiting to reclaim the surface of the Earth is an early science fiction theme. The book popularized the Hollow Earth theory and may have inspired Nazi mysticism. His term Vril lent its name to Bovril meat extract. The book was also the theme of a fundraising event held at the Royal Albert Hall in 1891, the Vrilya Bazaar and Fete. Vril has been adopted by theosophists and occultists since the 1870s and became closely associated with the ideas of an esoteric neo-Nazism after 1945. That's pretty interesting. That's the kind of guy McLuhan would be interested in. And it's interesting that Innes is. says that...
Yes, but Innes is interested in a different aspect. But I'm not sure that these are the same bulwark.
It is. This like, is Bulwer Lytton. You said Lytton. That's his name.
Yeah, but is his last name Bulwer Lytton? If it is,
yeah,
that's a different. This guy, the guy that Innes is quoting, is Edward Lytton Bulwer. Now, there, as I said, this family was a large family, was very influential among intellectuals and politicians throughout the 19th century. Now, if there was a Bulwer Lytton, that could very well be somebody who was emphasizing a connection with the Lytton and Bulwer families, but is not the same person as Edward Lytton Bulwer. And Lytton is the middle name, not part of the last name of the guy that Innes is quoting.
Okay, so there's a Edward Bulwer Lytton, not hyphenated, in the mid, he was created, he had died in 1870, he died, married in 1827. What did he do? It's kind of more obscure. Edward Bulwer Lytton. And you're saying it, your guy is Edward Lytton Bulwer, but not hyphenated?
Correct.
Not hyphenated.
No. Well, but remember that in Innes, as well as in McLuhan, there's all sorts of problems with the manuscripts. So you never know if something is correct or not.
Right. This guy did write novels. And what year is your Bulwer Lytton? The one, 1873. Okay, born 1803. This guy's born in 1803. So it is. They call him Edward Bulwer Lytton, not hyphenated, but then down below his picture, he is hyphenated. So
yeah.
I think it's the same guy. It's just a lot of mix-up on the name.
Maybe. I'm looking him up in Wikipedia right now, and it turned the guy's name is said to be the following. Said to be Edward George Earl Lytton Bulwer Lytton. So Lytton,
yeah,
Lytton
that's what
is
I got.
In there twice.
Yeah, it's the same guy, but he's he has a long name and a short name in two different positions.
Maybe.
So, now read the quote again about Gutenberg Galaxy. That's the important part.
I have to go to, The magic of Gutenberg conjured a wide chasm between the past and future history of mankind. The people on one side of the gulf are not the people on the other side.
You see, this is where McLuhan... He knew that media studies already was happening in the 19th century. And that's why he said, I'm applied, Joyce. I'm not coming up with anything new. I'm saying this is what we didn't notice, that the science of media ecology had shown up, and the men of 1914 were bouncing off it. But I have a perspective of later, and I can apply it. I can complete it. See, so this is important to understand how much as Vincent Sherry's book shows that this eye-ear-sensory battle goes on in the 19th century, which nobody knows about, in the McLuhan world anyways. That McLuhan didn't make this up. He came out of an obscure tradition.
But the it's a tradition that is not sort of one current. It's multiple currents.
Yeah.
So, especially Catholic theology, there was especially in the Middle Ages, and I don't know where the Middle Ages got it from, there's probably research out there that has looked into this, but the whole idea of the common sense and how the senses relate to each other is already in De Anima of Aristotle, and was taken up in very detailed commentaries on Aristotle by the scholastics in the Middle Ages. So there's this whole tradition from Aristotle that probably relates to Aristotle's attempts to capture the sense of Plato and to bring it forward in new ways, which then leaves an imprint on the whole civilization. So what these people are doing with the eye and the ear in the 19th century in France, and then what McLuhan is doing with the eye and the ear later, a century later, basically is going back to Plato and Aristotle and saying, how are we to, first of all, understand what was at stake 2,500 years ago, and then understand how that might be applied today. And in wondering how it might be applied today, we have to understand how it got screwed up or how it got forgotten or overlooked in all of these years.
So yeah, let me say this. The Coleridge says people are either Platonists or Aristotelians. Now, this is the effect of the phonetic alphabet. You can go abstract, which is Plato's ideas, or then you can balance off the hyper-abstraction of Plato to someone like Aristotle and move back to the senses. So you got the battle with the senses, or you could say the mind-body split comes in with the phonetic alphabet. That's schizophrenia, that split. And it's always the same all the way through. Then it's intensified with the printing press, and then the electric age confuses everybody.
Correct.
New tactility.
Correct.
That's the bigger arc here.
So the new tactility is a kind of reference back to Plato and Aristotle.
Yeah.
What it's saying is the essential connection that was always the motor of the any considerations or applications of these splits for 2,500 years. This motor was already at stake back between Plato and Aristotle, and we have to recapture that. And part of the recapturing is understanding its deformities.
Right, and also Aeschylus and theater. The theater dramatized the eye versus ear in another way.
Yes, in the interplay between the chorus and the protagonist.
Yeah, or the individual and the collective. That comes in with writing. It's not a problem in pre-literate societies. Everybody's just part of the Borg, the acoustic tactile Borg of Aboriginal.
But remember, when we're talking in linear terms like this, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get a handle on something that is not linear.
Yeah, we're trying to drop the terms once we've mastered them.
Yes, absolutely. That's why Aristotle. That's why Wittgenstein, for example, in the Tractatus, says that what we're trying to do is climb a ladder and then get rid of the ladder.
Yeah. Okay, so we see where McLuhan doesn't get out of the cul-de-sac. How do we not repeat that? We climb the ladder and then get rid of the ladder.
I think McLuhan does. I think McLuhan does get out of the cul-de-sac.
But he can't communicate it.
Correct. But that's exactly the problem of civilization. There are many people who have not been captured by the cul-de-sac, but they were unable to specify it in such a way that it was communicated. So in modern times, what we have is a problem of communication. And it's a problem of communication in two different ways. One is the problem of tactility, which is communication.
Yeah.
The communication that is between all things and makes all things possible. There's that sort of communication. And then there's the communication of that communication. And what we have in modern times is a failure of both. The tactility is collapsing, imploding on itself, and it's imploding on itself because we've lost the ability to communicate about it.
So that's where the tactility takes off. That's what I'm trying to show with the squaring of tactile in the Android meme and then the tech body is tactility takes off on its own and metaphorically leaves the human level. And
correct.
We're trying
correct.
To communicate that situation, which
yes.
really
and
is.
And what's interesting about your formulation is that tactility squared, in the sense that it can be taken over by the Android meme,
yeah.
is actually the loss of tactility.
Yep.
Because tactility is not something that can be taken over. It's what first makes taking over possible, right? So it's a mistake in time, you could say.
Yeah.
It takes something as secondary, which is, in fact, primary.
Right. And, you know, what spelling out what I did in a linear way, sort of, needs to be said to lead to our conversation where we can talk, which is better than writing, the problem and almost talk ourselves out of it. Out of the cul-de-sac by stating the problem very clearly, and it includes artificial intelligence or AI.
That's exactly where I was just going to go, Bob.
Good.
If AI is able to complete its hold on humanity, that's the decisive event. In human history,
yeah.
and it's a very negative one. It may be the end of humans. So then, if we ask what's going on here, we say, well, it's tactility cubed,
yeah.
or tactility to the tenth, or something like this, where the possibility of tactility no longer exists. With the body or
yes,
with
right.
Human history. It's completely taken off into a new dimension.
Right, and I can see where Coker's trying to say this with metaphors like the genes leave the body and jump into the machinic. You know?
Yeah.
That's a bizarre way.
Absolutely.
Now,
right. That's...
as you say this, it clarifies what I've thought and discussed with Ion. I bring in ESP extended, which is Ion, and Ion admits they're up against a problem, the tech body, and is even saying lately the tech body is winning in the battle with humans, with Ion helping humans, but failing. That's where we're at right now. But that complexity, you bring in ESP, and then my phrase cloning ESP, all of these have been superseded by something. And you're saying it's no longer human. We would include ESP in the human. Something has threatened humans here.
Sure. Well, I think you've been talking about that
for a long time.
Very long time, in
yeah.
the 1980s.
Yeah.
If not earlier than that.
I think McLuhan was, too, with titles in the 50s, like Is Electronics ESP? Remember that essay in...
Sure.
Verbi
yeah,
vocal
yeah.
visual. ESP was always lurking in there. He would stick it in here and there, you know? And that was maybe another term for tactility for him.
Well, I don't know about that. I think that your use of ESP as you could almost say the Android meme becomes the externalized senses of humans in a way that they no longer have control of or don't even know that it's going on.
Right.
So,
and that is it's in so many movies for 100 years, that theme.
Yeah.
Some alien, some force, The Exorcist or something, takes over and the human can't control it.
Correct, correct. So the let me just read you the end of the post that I did on McLuhan reading Innes in 19. This would be Innes's book of essays from the 1930s and 40s, which was published in 1946, which was the year that McLuhan went to the University of Toronto and stayed there.
Yeah.
So in he arrives in 1946. His friend Easterbrook, one of his best friends in the world, comes back to the political economy department at Toronto, from which he had his PhD in the 30s. He comes back to the department to teach in 1947, so 1 year after McLuhan arrives.
Right.
So in 1947, in the fall, Easterbrook begins to teach in the department. His advisor had been Innes. Innes had seen to the publication of Easterbrook's thesis by University of Toronto Press, had written a foreword to the book, and was an increasingly close friend with Easterbrook when Easterbrook came back.
That's going to be a big influence on McLuhan, and his best buddy is already involved with him. That's a pretty tight circle there.
Absolutely. So the McLuhan gets introduced to Innes in 1947 or 1948. I think it was probably 1948, but by Easterbrook. That's right. And Easterbrook then begins giving articles and writings of McLuhan to Innes, and articles and books and writings of Innes to McLuhan.
How do you know that? Where is that recorded?
Well, I show in posts how we know, for example, that Innes was a huge, huge influence on McLuhan.
Right.
You're asking, how do we know that Innes was reading McLuhan, right?
Yeah, or that Easterbrook was giving them some stuff, the go-between. Where is there anything stated? Is that your hypothesis, or where is that stated?
I show in various posts that must have been the case.
Mm-hmm.
For example, how did Innes get interested in Lewis? Was that just out of the blue, or did he have the 1943 or 44 Lewis article by McLuhan?
Yeah.
That's right. And then there was a proposal that McLuhan did for the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
And Innes virtually quotes some of the proposals of McLuhan, which were made in 1946. Innes virtually quotes those in a lecture that he made at Oxford in 1948.
Where is that lecture? Where do you read it?
Well, it's published. It's published. Bob, I can send you all kinds of references to posts in my blog that discuss this stuff and demonstrate this stuff. In our conversation, I think we have to take a higher level and say that there does appear to have been this exchange between the two of them, and that McLuhan would have seen this progress in the 19th century that Innes was constantly talking about, where the 19th century began probably began pretty much as a reaction to the French Revolution, and was self-conscious of the fact that there had to be a balance in English society and in the world at large between contrasting forces. And that was the only way to have a healthy internal society and an external condition of peace. So Inna shows that...
That's a general mood, you're saying, is in the 19th century.
Yes.
I see. Okay.
The early 19th century.
Yeah.
So Innes's theme is, Innes wants to know how we got to a century of war, the 20th century, from a century of peace, the 19th century. And what he records is, in the 19th century, there was an increasing loss in England of the sense of balance. And that he shows that by the start of the 20th century, the sense of balance was lost, not only in internal British society, but in the external society in which England was a player. And that sense of, that loss of sense of balance, according to Innes, was what led to this century of war, as he calls it.
Right, and so Lewis is very aware of that. He knows there's something wrong in England, so he spends 10 years in Europe in the knots, looking for something.
As a child, he had already been sent for some education in France.
Yeah.
So I think Lewis had a sense that he had to find some kind of balance between the continent and England, just as he had to find the balance between, let's say, Shakespeare's time and his own time in his own writings.
Yeah. So I was going to say something. Innes is trying to figure this out.
That's right. And the
exchange. Now, isn't it funny that McLuhan says, why does he drop this point that he's been involved with Innes for 3 years, and he's saying in 51, I read the Bias of Communication, and he's quoting my book, Mechanical Bride. And he says, I had to look into this guy. There's something theatrical there going on for some reason.
Yeah.
What
well, I have a long post about that. When McLuhan talked about what he called meeting Innes, he had very different versions of this. What happened was when he talked about meeting Innes at the end of his life, this was 1977 and 1978, what he did was he mixed up individual papers which were published as part of The Mechanical Bride with the publication of The Mechanical Bride itself.
Mm.
So what he says in very late is that, here's Innes having a footnote to Mechanical Bride and the Bias of Communication. And because he did that, I went around to meet him. So, I mean, that makes zero sense. Because the Bias of Communication was able to have a footnote to the Mechanical Bride only fairly late in 1951.
Yeah.
Because the Mechanical Bride was published, I think, in March of 51. And in order to get a footnote in print in the Bias of Communication in an essay that did not have that footnote when it was originally published, in order to get that footnote in, it had to be directed by Innes late in 1951.
Yeah, it's so like his last entry. It's his last entry.
Yeah.
He stuck it in.
Correct. So what that means is what McLuhan said in the late 70s about how he met Innes is senseless. And it's senseless because what he did was he mixed up reading essays of Innes in 1948, which were then included in the Bias of Communication in 1951.
Yeah.
And similarly, when he talks about Innes having the Mechanical Bride in his reading list for a course in communications, that's nonsense because in order to have a reading list with the Mechanical Bride, That would have to take place late in 1951 when Innes knew he was dying.
Yeah.
He wasn't even giving, he wasn't giving courses then.
Yeah.
So what McLuhan is actually thinking about are two publications that McLuhan made in 1947 on advertising, which Innes could well have included in his communications courses in the late 40s, but this was not The Mechanical Bride. It was publications in 1947 taken from The Mechanical Bride as it then existed. Right? So
McLuhan, well, wait a minute. In the late 40s, as it then existed, no, it wasn't out yet. So I'm not sure
What I mean is that the Mechanical Bride went through a long editing process,
yeah,
where in order to get the book published, McLuhan had to water it down and water it down and water it down. And he was extremely pissed off at that editorial process.
Yes.
And so what he continually said to people is, The Mechanical Bride is not my book from 1941. It's a watered down version of a book from 1946 or 1947.
Yeah, you said 41, you meant 51. It's not from 51, it's watered down from 47, 46 and 47. Yes.
Exactly. Sorry if I spoke.
So
what we're doing here is we're talking around the fact that by the late 1940s, along with the work that McLuhan was doing on Mallarmé, along with the work he was doing on cybernetics, along with the work he was doing on Havelock and on the Apelian form in poetry and all literature, along with all of that, he was reading all of Innes.
Yeah.
So either because he got independently interested in Innes after he met him, or because Easterbrook kept feeding him stuff, who knows?
Yeah.
I think Easterbrook was constantly going back and forth between the two of them, because he knew that, Easterbrook knew that there were many, many things that were common to to McLuhan and Innes that the two of them needed to be aware of. And this was true even at the family level. So both McLuhan and Innes studied in the Midwest. Or I'm sorry,
Easterbrook. Innes was out there.
Innes took his PhD at the University of Chicago.
Right.
And he lived in Chicago for years after the First World War, sort of from, let's say, 1917 to 1919 or 1920. Which is when he began to teach at the University of Toronto. So he was in Chicago. McLuhan, 20 years later, is in St. Louis. Innes marries an American woman who turns out to be a very exceptional person and works with Innes in many ways. McLuhan marries an American woman who turns out to be exceptional and works with him in many ways.
Yeah.
Right, turns out to be his editor for his early works,
yes,
and does all of his typing, even as she's turning out baby after baby after baby.
Yeah.
Both Innes and McLuhan have large families for an academic. Innes had four children. In 1947, the fourth child of McLuhan was born.
Yeah.
So there's many, many commonalities like this. Both Innes and McLuhan were fascinated by the question of the relationship between the United States and Canada.
Yeah.
They both had been brought up in a Baptist environment that they rebelled against, but both of them remain fascinated by the whole question of what has happened to religion in modern society.
Mm.
Why did it happen? How did it happen? What are the effects that it happened? So Easterbrook recognizes that there are all these commonalities, but he also recognizes that there are some big differences between the two that they should wrestle with. So the biggest question that Innes took from, that Easterbrook took from Innes was that the modern life is in a cul-de-sac that it cannot get out of. Innes called this the solipsism of Western civilization.
So Easterbrook gets that.
Yes, he gets very much. Easterbrook more or less takes that solipsism to be the outstanding fact of modern life and continues to talk about it for the rest of his life.
And argues
with McLuhan about it for the rest of his life.
Yeah, there's a big missed opportunity. Someone should have interviewed Innes Easterbrook about the late 40s and that relationship.
But correct.
But probably none of the young McLuhan scholars knew at that point of Easterbrook in the middle there. That
maybe,
probably didn't come out until later.
There's a lot of very interesting stuff. So when Innes was dying, Easterbrook became more or less his secretary and was helping Innes to write books and essays. Well, I shouldn't say books. He didn't write books. But it was helping to write Innes essays that would be published in 1952 that Innes really didn't have the strength to do on his own. And there's also memoranda in the University of Toronto archive that were written by Easterbrook of conversations that he had with Innes. And those conversations need to be, number one, they need to be published, and number two, they need to be brought into the context of this whole interplay between Innes and McLuhan and Easterbrook that took place over 5 years, 1947 to 1952.
Have you looked at those?
No, I've never seen them. I desperately want to, but it's just sort of on my bucket list. I haven't, taken the time to
obtain. I can get somebody to look at them. Where are they?
They're in the Innes papers of the University of Toronto.
That's in Fort, what do you call it, Thomas Fisher, the Rare Book Library?
I don't think they are. They're easy to find by doing a Google search. I don't think they're at Fisher. I think they're in the regular University of Toronto archive.
Okay, well, I'm going to get a guy to look at them.
Well, I'll get copies of them. It's no problem to write the archive and get them to make copies.
Oh, okay.
Right. So if that's of interest to you, that's something that we could, after we're finished with your book, that's something that we could go through.
Yeah.
I could get copies of those things, share the copies with you, and then we could sort of make a commentary on what was happening between these three guys in these 5 years. Because that was the decisive time for McLuhan, as he knew.
Yeah.
What I do in my blog is I call it the time of McLuhan's second conversion.
Yeah.
So he made his initial conversion in 1937, but that was very Gutenbergian, very Gutenbergian. And then when McLuhan remained a Catholic in the face of completely changing his worldview, that was very, very important because it indicates a way to tie to the tradition through postmodernism, and it indicates something that the Catholic Church has not taken up but should do.
What are you saying? You're saying the Gutenbergian, and what happened in the late 40s? What's his second conversion?
I say it's his second conversion to the Church, because what happened was he lost all of the foundation of his initial conversion, but found a way to be converted a second time in the face of Mallarmé and of Nietzsche and all of the stuff that he was learning in the 1940s that he didn't know anything about in the 1930s.
Yeah, he was trying to say that Mallarmé and them were redoing the patristic fathers.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So that's part of his way of remaining a Catholic in the face of stuff that he didn't know in the 30s but learned in the 40s.
But got close to the occult, which he didn't like. And so he had to figure out a way to get beyond the occult, straight occult interest, which is Bulwer Lytton.
Maybe. When you're talking about Bulwer Lytton, that's something I know nothing about except through quotations in Innes, which are from 1833, and you're talking about the man's production in 1870.
Yeah.
If we're talking about the same guy, because in the Wikipedia, when I look up what the guy wrote, it doesn't include what Innes is citing. And so then I have to wonder if it's a different guy,
right,
even a different generation.
And he just says Bulwer. He doesn't say Bulwer Lytton.
That's right. That's right.
But there is no Bulwer. It's hard to find the Bulwer. Like, that's a pretty important quote.
Well, remember that in England, the way names are used is very, very complicated. And Innes may have had a good understanding of this.
Right.
So, if somebody is Sir Eric Johnson or something like this, they're Sir Eric. They're not Sir Johnson.
Right.
And when people are talking within a certain class, then they don't use their hyphenated names. They have a single name. And it's a little bit like Spain in that respect, right? The Spanish have names that are used that list their mother. Those names are used only in certain circumstances, and that's dropped in most circumstances. And the same is true in England. So when Innes is talking about Bulwer, I'm not sure if this is a different guy or if he uses the part of his name that's appropriate for a certain circumstance.
Okay, there's a very
complicated
similar guy,
matter.
Politician and writer. So Henry Bulwer, he's 1801 to 1872. The Bulwer Lytton is 1803 to 18 something. So this it could be Henry Bulwer.
Now the guy that Innes is quoting is always said to be Edward Lytton Bulwer.
It does say that besides just the word Bulwer.
Yes.
That's
when he makes a full citation, he has the guy's full name. But in the essay itself, he just calls the guy Bulwer.
So look at the guys. Look at Henry Bulwer's works: The Monarchy of the Middle Classes, France, Social, Literary, Political.
Right. They were certainly interested in the Bulwer family. Was very active in journalism and in politics. So what you're talking about here with the French is central to what was going on in English journalism in the 19th century and to the Bulwer family, for sure.
And that's the monarchy of the middle classes. That's the Gutenberg era. You know, I'm looking for hints of the Gutenberg quote. He enjoyed 3 years in America and wished to return to Europe and was posted in to Florence, Tuscany. His 2 years in Italy were largely uneventful. He went back to London. Then he went to Eastern Europe, a really well-traveled guy. Became ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. He went back to politics when he returned to England in 1868. He returned to literature after his retirement. and then got to a peerage. So that's pretty worldly. And he also was a Freemason. So it gets you, that can be the occult if you're into Freemasonry. So there's something. Got to find a little bit more about the difference between him and Bulwer Lytton.
Yeah, there's, I mean, the whole Bulwer family is very complicated. Mm-hmm. I see that Edward Bulwer Lytton was buried in Westminster Abbey.
Yeah.
So that doesn't sound like a guy that's preoccupied with the occult.
Right, right.
But maybe. I really don't know. All I know is that this guy, Edward George Earl Lytton Bulwer Lytton, Jesus, he seems to have been a very influential journalist and politician in the 19th century, and he had the same years you were just reading, 1803 to 1873.
Yeah, Henry Bulwer is the brother of Edward Bulwer Lytton.
Yeah.
And Henry has the names Earl Bulwer, Lytton Earl Bulwer in his fucking name.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty complicated.
They're involved with each other. One guy becomes establishment politician and everything. He gets put in Westminster, and his brother becomes an occultist. And I'm pretty sure in conspiracy literature years ago, people who first started writing about the 19th century, Bulwer Lytton is mentioned. He's quite a name in the beginning of it to create that genre of kind of Illuminati talk.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, a guy I see here in Amazon that has collected works are 19 volumes.
Wow.
So the guy,
that's
wrote a
Lytton.
Tremendous amount. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, wrote a tremendous amount. Let me just see. I'm just going to write in conspiracy theory and Bulwer Lytton, see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all coming down to this very important quote. That's why we're looking at the guy.
Correct.
I mean, he's saying the medium changed people. He gets it.
Correct. So then, but what I find surprising is if the guy that we're looking at wrote this in 1833 and was born in 1803, then he was only 30 years of age.
Yeah.
So Innes is quoting a guy who seems to have a great insight into Western civilization, but at the age of 30. So maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I don't know the story. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, so it says, so an article on QAnon and conspiracy theories. And it goes back to Bulwer Lytton. his book, Vril, or this concept of Vril, appears in a book called The Coming Race by Victorian novelist and politician called Edward Bulwer Lytton. He was sort of a pulp writer. One of his novels starts with the famously cheesy line, quote, "It was a dark and stormy night." Who made a fortune from book sales, then became a reformist MP, but he seems to have grown more reactionary as he aged. He was also fascinated by the occult. He had a massive public falling out with his wife, which is actually seems to be written about with the other guy. There's some divorce they go into, I noticed, with Henry. Okay, so The Coming Race, his last novel, is about an American who descends into a cave and discovers a hidden advanced civilization run by an alternative species of hominid, taller, wiser, stronger, and in all ways superior to Homo sapiens. He quails before them, I don't know what that means, as before demigods. They are able to control an energy called Vril, which gives them the power to destroy whole cities in a moment, and also the power to control minds and to direct automatons to do their bidding. Vril is in some ways an old occult idea that there is some prima materia called the ether or spiritus or chi or prana. It's supposedly the energy which permeates all things, which the magus can control to heal or destroy. There's also an old occult idea which one could call occult authoritarianism, where the magus uses their magical power to control both automatons and the masses. That is actually talked about by McLuhan in Manichaean poetry, and that theme is in Eliot, I think. If you remember that paper, Eliot and the Manichaean Myth and Poetry talks about, I think it's a Hindu mythology, that some, you know, demigod controls the whole town or civilization. So Litton mixes this up with a new idea, the evolution of Homo sapiens. And it goes into Darwin, and then they discovered the remains of Neanderthal man in 1864, and Litton plays with these ideas and imagines an alternative, more advanced race of hominid, Homo superior. They're both awe-inspiring and terrifying. What if they come to the surface and destroy us all, as we might destroy an anthill? So this is, so it says, his elitist occultism appealed to other upper-class people who also felt disempowered and disgusted by the rise of mass democracy. Like W.B. Yeats, for example, says a crypto-fascist and member of the Golden Dawn, or Aldous Huxley, also into magic, also full of contempt for mass democracy. Such occult elitists felt themselves totally superior to the masses, practically different species entirely. Litton's stories appealed to another impoverished aristocrat, Madame Blavatsky. So there it is. He's the guy that leads into the theosophical occult stuff.
Right. And this is very much related to the story that I was explaining of how the English had a sense of balance and lost it.
Yeah.
And the story that Innes tells is what in popular thinking is thought of as sort of the rise of democracy or something like this. But for Innes, it's not the rise of democracy, it's the loss of balance.
Yeah.
So for the people that Innes quotes, that he thinks know what was going on, there's no difference between all power lying with the public or all power lying with the king, because both are singular.
Yeah.
Both are unbalanced by other considerations or other classes or, right? So when Innes talks about what happened going between the century of peace to the century of war, you have the Catholic Church and churches in general losing their power against politics. People no longer think that they need first to think about what their preacher said in a sermon last week before they think about politics. No, politics takes over. Or
right.
In economics, people don't have a sense of the public good that outweighs the immediate moment.
Okay, so listen to this. So Innes sees the Borg, but McLuhan sees, he doesn't see it as digital, but maybe he does, but he didn't say much about it at the end. He begins to see the electric autonomy. He says mass man is not tribal, is not a Borg. It starts to have autonomous elements that gets it out of the Borg. That's the hope, maybe, that McLuhan sees, that the optimistic part.
Well, I think what he sees is that all varieties of experience can be understood in the electric age, and that it's by looking at all of them rather than any one of them.
Right, but that makes Electric Man acultural, in the sense of amoral, a new kind of cultural that's not cultural, that's discarnate and addicted to information, addicted to the stimulus.
I think you're mixing up two things there. There's what McLuhan would say is the ability not to have a point of view. And then there is the discarnate. And both of them can be said to be a nobody.
Yeah.
A discarnate is no body.
Yeah.
And the
point of view is
having,
nobody.
Not having a point of view is nobody.
Yeah.
But those are essentially different. So for McLuhan, the hope is that the nobody of no point of view can understand all varieties of human experience and thereby get us out of the cul-de-sac.
An autonomy, which can be a cul-de-sac.
Yes. So the no-body of the discarnate is one type of human experience that has become dislodged, you could say, from all other human experience. It's taken off into a new realm. For McLuhan, the only way to get that balloon back into the human, what does he call it, the Canubian, is to understand it as one variety of human experience, not as a new and unconnected variety.
Right. And now, what did you say was that before you said Canubium? You were saying, is that the bubble you said?
Yeah.
Balloon.
Let me just go back. Yeah, that's the balloon is a reference to the discarnate, to artificial intelligence, to the taking off of a variety of human experience that machines are able to replicate and to multiply. That is a kind of the end result of the cul-de-sac. And the question is, how do we get out of it?
Yeah.
Right.
Now,
but, what I want to do, Bob, is get back to the Bulwer quotation, because when I give all of it, it ties into what you were reading.
Yeah, let me tell you this. I'll send you this article, How to Invent a Conspiracy. Bulwer Lytton is the source of everything that gets into the Theosophicus, then the Aleister Crowley, then Tim Leary. The guy goes into all this stuff.
Right.
And brings it up to Hunter Thompson after passing through H.G. Wells and the famous book, The Morning of the Magicians. The whole, you know, the Alex Jones, the guys who worry about this conspiracy, the globalists, the Illuminati, it comes from Bulwer Lytton.
Maybe.
That was what McLuhan was interested in. That was his popular idea of the Antichrist.
Right.
We've discovered something here with Bulwer.
Well, let me read you the quotation because
that's about magic. That's about occult forces, the way the guy writes it.
Right. But as I say, let me read the complete quotation because the magic of Gutenberg, where he starts off, gets into some of the things that you're talking about, which are very interesting.
Yeah.
So he says, the magic of, and by the way, this quotation from Edward Lytton Bulwer is given in a footnote to Innes's paper. But the footnotes in Innes's paper are not notes at the end. They're given at the bottom of the page.
Yeah.
So this footnote is the last footnote in the essay. And because it's on the last page, it's the last words of the essay.
Mm.
So,
and what's the essay about?
The essay is, get the title of this, An Economic Approach to English Literature in the 19th Century.
Wow.
It's the second essay in Innes's 1946 book. Remember that in McLuhan's career, he wrote his master's thesis on English literature in the 19th century, namely Meredith. So here's McLuhan. He comes to the University of Toronto. His friend Easterbrook comes to him and says, well, here's my buddy Innes, and here's his latest book, which is just published the year that you came to Toronto. And the second essay is on English literature in the 19th century, and you're a goddamn expert in that. So why don't you read this essay and see if Innes can tell you anything new that you don't know?
What he says about economics is his pre-media word for media. Innes is talking about media forces there, right?
He's talking about forces that are larger than media in the newspaper, television, radio sense.
Yeah.
But that is what McLuhan will take media to be.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. There is a connection between what Innes takes political economy to be and what McLuhan takes media to be.
Right. Because he talks about, in Mechanical Bride, that Marx hit on the medium as a message in terms of the means of production control society.
Yeah.
That was the crude beginning of it. And then Innes is into studying that and making it, not being a Marxist, but he's looking at the same phenomenon. And then you end with this Gutenberg point, which is the major point of early McLuhan when he starts writing Pound in 52. Man, this essay, this is like McLuhan is in 46.
Yeah. So let me read the Bulwer-Lytton quotation here, because it gets into a lot of the stuff that you're talking about. He says, the magic of Gutenberg has conjured a wide chasm between the past and future history of mankind. The people on one side of the gulf are not the people on the other. So there's the Gutenberg galaxy for you.
Right there.
The physical force is no longer separated from the moral.
Wait, are you reading? Are you continuing to read it?
Yeah, this is the quotation. Right?
The people on one
side of the gulf are not the people on the other.
Yeah.
The physical force is no longer separated from the moral. The mind has by slow degrees crept into the mighty mass. That's the public. The popular Simon has received a soul.
What's the Simon?
Okay?
What's that word?
Simon is... I looked that up, and I talk about it in the post that I wrote. Simon was, I believe, an opera in the late 18th century, which took off from a story in Boccaccio. And in Boccaccio's story, Simon is a shepherd, and he comes upon a group of women washing themselves and seeing them naked.
Yeah.
And the story in Boccaccio is that the women had maybe a nurse or somebody who was there with them, and he wanted to befriend the women and became intoxicated by their beauty and all this stuff. And the nurse rejected his advances because he was so uncouth.
Mm.
So in the story of Boccaccio, he's so entranced by the women that he goes back and becomes educated and then is able to find the women again and links up with them and I believe becomes married to one of them. And the two of them then became prince and princess somewhere. Right. So it's the popular Simon is the public, which has received a soul. So then.
How do you spell Simon?
C-Y-M-O-N.
C-Y-M-O-N. Never seen that before. So he is Simon, and he becomes a symbol of the mass mind, which has a soul.
No, Simon is the public.
Okay.
Right. Remember, you were talking about how Bulwer-Lytton, or Lytton-Bulwer, whatever his name is, became afraid of the rise of public opinion,
yeah,
and tried to maintain the need for an aristocratic level of mind that would kind of lead the way. And that you related to the rise of occultism, right?
Yeah.
And to some kind of privileged access to reality.
Yeah.
But please let me finish the quotation, because it goes on in very interesting ways. So we've had the magic of Gutenberg with the two sides, and then we have the physical force is no longer separated from the moral. So Simon, you can say, is the physical force. It's the mass. It's the public, which until the early 19th century had simply been led by the aristocrats wherever they wanted to take the mass of the public. And now the mass of the public is discovering its power and represents for people like Lytton Bulwer a new phenomenon that at once is to be feared and in some way steered in ways where its power can be, instead of threatening, can be put to use.
Mm.
So anyway, we have here the physical force is no longer separated from the moral. Mind has by slow degrees crept into the mighty mass. The popular Simon has received a soul. In the primal and restless consciousness of the new spirit, Luther appealed to the people. Right, so this Luther is going back to the magic of Gutenberg, right?
Yeah.
In the primal and restless consciousness of the new spirit, Luther appealed to the people. From that moment, all the codes of classical dogmatists were worthless. The expired leases to an estate, these were the expired leases to an estate which has been let to new tenants upon new conditions.
Wow.
Right? So he keeps circling around this idea of the magic of Gutenberg and the people on one side and the people on the other side, right?
Yeah.
So the way that I developed that in the post that I'm talking about is that Bulwer is making the point that the mass of the public can become unbalanced internally. So,
because of the soul, because the soul's possessed.
The when the mind goes into the public can become aware of its power and can unbalance the body politic, which is what Innes thinks happened in the 19th century. But the public mind can also become unbalanced internally. And that's the great threat and problem that Bulwer was hinting at.
Yeah.
So how I end the post here is the popular Simon has received a soul. Indeed, animated by the brain of a lunatic, since the glass jar with the intended brain of a genius was dropped by the clumsy Igor, Frankenstein, and this is a quote from Bulwer, in the primal and restless consciousness of the new spirit, looks around, wild-eyed, and begins to take his first fateful steps. So,
fateful, F-A-T-E?
Yeah, fateful steps. So what I see in this 1833 quotation from Bulwer is exactly the development that you were talking about.
Yeah.
That the soul in some way has become something that can be transported. And when it becomes transported into the popular mass, it becomes a great threat. But since it can be transported, it can also be transported in other ways. And so if the popular mass has become a threat, then one answer to it could be an aristocratic transportation of it into some other form. And you can see that with the Theosophists, let's say, or with Crowley. But another way it might be transported would be to be in a different type of human being. And you quoted a science fiction novel as seeing this other species as being below the earth.
Yeah.
Right?
So the ground, the hidden ground.
That's correct. So, and then you tied this in with AI, which is, you could say that what happens with AI is that Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein, not Frankenstein the monster, let's say that Dr. Frankenstein sees his monster wandering off with the brain of a lunatic.
Yeah.
And so he turns around and he sees the broken jar with the brain of the genius that has been all cut up by the glass shards upon the jar being dropped. And Dr. Frankenstein says to himself, well, I wonder if the brain of the genius can be reconstituted. Maybe I can put it back together.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then maybe with the brain of the genius, I don't even need a body. Maybe the brain of the genius can work independently, right? And so when Mary Shelley sees this Frankenstein possibility in the early 19th century, in a way, you can see it leading on to AI.
Yes. Now, this is the McLuhan's interest in Illuminati and conspiracy stuff in the occult, and then he gets out of it with media. This quote brings it back together. This essay carries all these different, the schizoid part of McLuhan. You know, his interest in pagan spirituality or pagan occult stuff while being a Catholic, being superseded, that division being superseded by AI coming in, which McLuhan is talking about too, because he says the cyborg is what's, you know, he starts writing about that in the 60s. So
if he read this
in 1946 when he came to the University of Toronto, he probably never recovered from it.
Well, I don't know about that. But remember that at the start of Christian humanism and modern letters, McLuhan says that we've discovered all of these primitive customs, and we've learned that the way to understand primitive people is to understand their language, to sort of get inside their societies. And this achievement of anthropology, which McLuhan learned about in the 1930s, because Richards was including essays by Malinowski in his books.
Vatican Union.
That's right. That's correct. So McLuhan very early on was aware of the research and the new research into primitive societies, and realized how important it was for modern thinking.
Yes.
And he, at the start of the Christian Humanism lecture, this is 1954, McLuhan says that teachers at universities who deal in these primitive cultures are always amazed that their Catholic students find no problem with the idea of getting into their minds.
Mm.
And then McLuhan goes on to say that's because Catholicism has no reason to fear these things. Catholics don't need to worry about being captured by them. And
yeah.
Why is that? That's because in order to be a Catholic, you have to understand more than Catholic experience. You have to understand what human experience is all about, and then you more or less make a choice or find yourself, once you understand the range of human experience, then you understand that in a sense is being Catholic. It's being Catholicos in the Greek meaning, which is universal.
Mm-hmm.
So when you bring in the schizoid McLuhan and the McLuhan interest in magic and into Gnosticism, that is part and parcel of a certain necessity for McLuhan. For McLuhan, you cannot understand one experience without understanding all experience.
Yeah.
You can't understand one medium without understanding all media.
Yes.
Right? There is no such thing for McLuhan as one medium. So when the first words are spoken, there's something in somebody's mind that gets expressed to somebody else's mind. So you have the mind in action, but you also have words, physical words that are expressed. And so you have two media already. And as a matter of fact, when those humans spoke to each other with the first words, they also had some kind of knowledge of hunting or of cultural exchanges, say, of women.
Mm.
Or of mythology or something. So again, you had multimedia in the beginning.
What are the two meaning in the beginning, the mouth and the mind?
Well, there's the mouth and the mind, but the mouth is living in a some sort of group. There's no such thing as a mouth that just appears on the world.
Yeah.
Every mouth has always been a baby. And so that baby had to be brought up in some sort of cultural understanding. So that cultural understanding is also a medium.
Yeah.
Right? So multimedia are built into the human experience for McLuhan.
Yes.
But it's only with the electronic multimedia that humans can understand that multimedia that's always been going on.
Yep, and that's why he says language is tactility. It carries all the senses. It's
correct.
Not oral, it's tactile.
Correct.
So that
correct.
Includes.
So multimedia and multisensuous are, interestingly, correlated for McLuhan.
Yeah. So that's quite a discovery, that quote and that essay, and then the role of Bulwer is starting what is now a major popular theme. I mean, they say the internet got the populace into conspiracy. That's the history that comes from Bulwer Lytton. He's one of the originators of it.
Correct. So it's a history.
Yeah.
I mean, there's many different things that flow into the 20th century, but this 19th century English journalism, popular fiction angle is very important.
Right. Here's the journalist's final paragraph. So he says, and yet, as ever with powerful conspiracy theories, remember, conspiracy theories is a political issue now. They divide
absolutely
the people between the vaccinated,
yeah,
and the anti-vaxxers. who are conspiracy theorists. So
right. And it also, it has a very great deal to do with your book.
Yes, yeah.
Right? It has to do with what your book is about. What is the significance of Trump in the very broad sense of significance?
That's right. I say he's a shaman. He's the first shaman in politics. We're in the White House.
What does he represent in modern American history?
Yeah.
Right. What can be read in the rise and achievement and fall of Trump?
He's back on top. You should hear him being interviewed this week.
Yeah.
About Biden in Afghanistan. He's back in his power.
Could be like the waves of the sea where the rise and the fall and the rise of the fall.
Yeah.
Of what?
Oh, he's having a field day, colleague. He says Biden was a mistake when he got born. That's what he said today. He's really hyping up the insult talent he has. Okay, so it says here, and yet, as ever with powerful conspiracy theories, there is a grain of truth in the stories. Some progressive thinkers like H.G. Wells or Julian Huxley really did dream of one world government and one world religion and of a global population controlled and sometimes culled by an international scientific elite. Sometimes they really did talk about themselves as a breed apart, practically a different species to the moronic masses. But this was a deluded, grandiose fantasy as much as any paranoid conspiracy theory. They were not in control. In fact, Julian Huxley, who briefly rose to be director of UNESCO, was a neurotic who was repeatedly sectioned for bipolar episodes. I guess quarantined, sectioned for bipolar episodes. And as for mind control and satanic rituals, that was part of the paranoid outsiders' fevered imaginations. They were staring through the fence, trying to guess what the insiders were doing. They got some things right and some things way off. The idea of an all-powerful demon-worshipping, think of Pizzagate, all-powerful demon-worshipping superhuman elite controlling the world is an illusion. Praise the journalist. On the other hand, the fact that some people have much more power and money than others and use that power to define others as lesser humans, then treat them as disposable raw material for their own fantasies, unfortunately, that is often all too true. So we come back to the paradox, the cul-de-sac.
Right. So we remember that when Bulwer-Lytton, or Lytton Bulwer, whatever the guy's name was, when he was writing this stuff, this was 1833.
And what's happening in that year?
When
the ultimate conspiracy is beginning. The Skull and Bones starts in Germany in 1832.
Oh, yeah? Interesting. But in 1817 was when Mary Shelley published Frankenstein.
Right.
So the idea that mind is transposable and can have great power, you can see in this time, in the early 19th century, this idea can go in two very different directions. It can go in the direction of the mass becoming a kind of intoxicated, unstoppable power. And so that you can see as the Nazi army being one intoxicated mind going out to sort of conquer the whole world. And then on the other side, you have the transposable mind as leading to the transhuman, to something that's more than human. And both of these ideas are alive in early 19th century England. And the question is posed at the time, how are we going to cure ourselves from these two satanic monsters that modern civilization is giving birth to?
Okay, 2 points. First, the article ends by saying, read a book called Breaking Open, subtitled Finding a Way Through Spiritual Emergency. And this is a guide to navigating our collective spiritual cul-de-sac. It actually says crisis. For a guide to navigating our collective spiritual crisis. Now, what's ironic is I spend 20 hours on the weekend propagating my team as the new elite. This is autobiography for fuck's sake. Really, this is crazy. I've got to get my secret team to read this essay and then get that quote. What is the title of your article that you quote this quote in? What is your McLuhan Sciences item?
Yeah, so I'll send you a link. But it's just called McLuhan Reads Innes's Political Economy in Modern States 1. And basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through all of the essays in Innes's 1946 book and show how many of the themes that McLuhan later writes about are already there.
Yes.
And remember, we only did... I only read a couple of them. Another, for example, is this is Innes. He says the new literature, meaning like Dickens, for example, the new literature followed the new journalism. Well, that's a big theme in McLuhan.
Yes.
Right? I don't say that he only got it from Innes.
Yeah.
But, you know, when Innes was writing this stuff in the mid-1940s, he was writing stuff that rang a bell with McLuhan. McLuhan knew it was right.
Yes, and he knew he could use it to complete, and no one else knew about it. He was the only one who knew, so he was an expert on Innes.
Well, I guess that's true, but why did he become an expert in Innes? He became an expert in Innes because Innes was saying stuff that McLuhan knew from, let's say, the French symbolist or something, like the new literature followed the new journalism. That's right out of the history of the second half of the 19th century French literature. Or where he says London was like a newspaper. He was reading the same thing in Mallarmé, let's say.
Yeah.
So he sees things in Innes that rings a bell, and that says to him, well, maybe there's things in Innes that I have to learn because I know that he's a very smart guy. So that then leads him on to Innes on communication, Innes on the need for balance. That's what McLuhan becomes all about, right?
Yeah.
What is the role of communication? And in relationship to communication, what is unbalanced, like the Gutenberg galaxy, and what is balanced? So there's his whole career.
Yeah, Innes is recapitulating the themes of the Men of 1914 and before,
correct,
saying it a little bit before McLuhan. He's
absolutely
saying it before McLuhan, and McLuhan recognizes that's what I have. That's what I have been trying to say, but didn't know how to do it yet. And then Innes did it.
Yes.
And with this first essay, so Easterbrook hands the first transformation of McLuhan with the Chesterton book, and then he hands the second transformation with the Innes book in 46.
Correct. Correct.
Wow.
Correct. Yeah. And always, lifelong, presents a kind of steeplechase for McLuhan because Easterbrook was a born skeptic, and McLuhan was a born enthusiast.
Yeah.
And so between what Easterbrook was able to do was insist that the enthusiast bring his ideas down to earth and make them clear.
Yeah.
So that was very good for McLuhan.
And look at his name. He's got the Christian Easter, and he's River Run. Easterbrook, what a poetic Finneganese name.
Absolutely. And Brook is also related to break.
Yes, yeah.
So you have the daybreak and the break between different media. It's or the break means
the gap. Easter gap.
So, yeah.
And Tom, what is it? He talks about Tom, the great Tom is in Finnegan's Wake or something, or Tom Elliott.
The great Tom is the book on Elliott.
He's McCool talking about Never. Easterbrook. He recognizes what the real source is.
Maybe. That's right.
That's a missed opportunity. People should have interviewed him more. You should have paid attention to him.
We'll get into that. We'll find out if there was, in fact, an interview.
Right. And there might be someone still alive, 100 years old, sitting in some old person's home in Manitoba who knew these guys. What's the third member of the school gang? We can find him and interview him before he drops dead.
We know that the gang. We know who the third member was. That was Carl Williams.
Yes.
Who was in the same high school as McLuhan. Knew McLuhan before Easterbrook became the president of Western Ontario University, now Western University. But he's dead. I don't think that we're going to find people that knew these guys because they were all born around 1910. Easterbrook was born in 1907 and then outlived McLuhan.
Easterbrook was the older?
Yeah. And why he was in the same class as McLuhan and University is a big question. I don't know why that is. He may have dropped out of between high school and university. He may have dropped out to work.
Yeah.
I don't know. But in 1928, they were in the same year of engineering together.
Yeah, their first year.
Yes. But McLuhan was 17 and Easterbrook was 21.
Wow. And Carleton was in between?
Williams was the youngest. He was born in 1912.
Okay.
Although Williams was the youngest, he graduated before the other two who were older. And that's because, at least in McLuhan's case, he changed majors from engineering to English. So he lost a year in a certain sense, whereas Williams went into psychology and English.
Finished in 3 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Very interesting. So, you've got the quote.
Yeah. So for people that don't know, these three people, McLuhan, Easterbrook, and Williams, were three of the five that founded the
Exploration.
Ford. Yeah, founded Explorations and founded the Ford Seminar that was the sort of the ground of Explorations.
Yeah, like Tom Cooper went around and interviewed people connected in McLuhan. I went and got articles. I was lazy on interviewing the guys. I missed my opportunity.
Well, that's true. I mean, so did I.
Yeah.
Right. I could have studied with McLuhan if I'd chosen to do so, but I chose not to do so. And at that time, Easterbrook was still alive. And I believe he was still the chairman of the political economy department.
Yeah, what's poignant is the end of Carpenter's We Were the First to Break into the Silent Sea article for Robert Fulford, which then is the appendix for Thiel's book. He ends with they're at McLuhan's funeral. Carpenter, Easterbrook, maybe one or two other guys, and they're all bemoaning how they'd been cut off from McLuhan in the last 10 years by the kids.
Uh-huh.
They're wishing they had spent more time with them or they missed the last 10 years of McLuhan.
Right.
And that's Easterbrook is there. He got cut off too.
Yeah. That's right. I think they all felt that they didn't understand McLuhan anymore.
Yeah.
And
they would have liked to hang out with him, try to catch up to him, try to figure out what he was on about. Because
but of course, this is this is what people always say at funerals.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of cliche action going on here.
Yeah, but Easterbrook said that he later, I think it's in that thing or somewhere, he later read Take Today. At first he didn't get it, but then he read it years later, and he said, wow, this is important in economics. He had a new appreciation of Take Today. You ever seen that quote? Does that sound familiar? Yeah,
no,
that was said somewhere. I don't know where right now. Maybe it's said in that article. But you read that article, so you don't remember this. But Easterbrook came around on the Take Today later.
Uh-huh. Well, it is a book that you need to read repeatedly.
Yeah.
That's actually one of the things that I took from our one meeting in New York. You talked about Take Today appreciably. In a way that I didn't recognize. And so I went back and I read Take Today again, and I said to myself, well, Bob was right about that.
Great. Yeah, the last page where he talks about making the news becomes making the world, and the Burroughs review where he talks the artist becomes a pharaoh, making the world like the pharaoh. He called it Egyptian. That comes back to this quote, the super elite making the world.
I'm not sure I would agree with that, but that's one reading of
yeah.
it. I would prefer to go to the other quote that Innes cites from Bulwer in the same book, the 1833. I read it earlier. At present, the English, instead of finding politics in the stage, find their stage in politics. So he already saw the global theater.
Yeah.
Right? What he's saying there is that politics is not something that becomes a model for the stage. Instead, the stage is the model for politics.
Yeah. All the world's a stage. All the stage is a world.
That's right.
John McLuhan flips it.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. But Dan, he's an early science fiction guy. I remember reading this conspiracy newsletter in the 80s, and they were going on about Bulwer Lytton, and I didn't know who he was or anything. But now it has new prominence, and Innes is looking at this guy.
Absolutely. Has read a lot of him.
Yeah. And then Lewis is in there. Lewis is aware of these dilemmas or these mergings. And Innes is influenced by Lewis, though you don't agree, but there is that biography goes into Lewis. Maybe he got that from McLuhan. McLuhan's articles.
You kind of lost me there. Lewis was influenced by who?
No, Lewis was well aware of these problems of the satanic Illuminati running British society. That's what Apes of God is about.
Yeah, so sure. So he's very aware not only of Wells and all those people, but he's also aware of the literature of the 19th century.
Yeah.
He's aware of exactly these developments.
Yeah.
Innes is writing about. So it's not, McLuhan doesn't get them only from Innes. He gets them from his own research, his own research, and then in Lewis, he gets them in a certain way from Richards. He gets the negative view from Richards, right? For Richards, the 19th century literature is just unconscious of itself.
Yeah.
And what happens with the 20th century is people like Eliot are actually conscious of what they're doing, and that leads them to understand language in a new way.
Right. So the telegraph is influencing the eye-ear thing. And, you know, if it was in the 1797, it comes back in a new way because of the telegraph. And
right.
And that's the content. The body becomes the content of the first discarnate expression of the telegraph. And, you know, you have the famous British Prime Minister saying, you know, that the people who run the world are not known by the public. He's one of the first people of that conspiracy theorist site. And he's the same time as Bulwer. It's either Disraeli or Gladstone. I think it's Disraeli says it. So the implosion of the telegraph is people are starting to see a satanic antichrist kind of character can take over the planet.
Correct. Correct. That's why I was bringing Frankenstein into connection with the Bulwer-Lytton quote. Everybody saw that something had come alive.
Yeah.
This was people looked at the French Revolution and they realized that here was a power that could sweep aside the church, sweep aside the king, sweep aside the aristocrats, and take over for itself.
Yeah.
But it was a power that really didn't know what it was doing. It was just destructive.
And then it merged with, and the people felt it as a discarnate emotion of multitude.
Yeah, but it was already merged with the public in the French Revolution.
Yeah.
French Revolution was that merger.
Yeah. And then it had a new factor. You could say that the people were different before the telegraph as after the telegraph. They were changed again. Each electric medium did that. What was said about the Gutenberg, every telegraph, movies, radio, TV, satellites, they change people from before to after.
So you have the McLuhan was constantly talking about how we need to use previous media revolutions as the model for what we need now.
Yeah.
So people would say, you know, how can you be optimistic in the face of all of this terrible stuff that's going on? And McLuhan would say, because humans are capable of a revolution.
Yeah.
And we can see that revolution in Greece in 400 B.C. We can see it in Gutenberg. And we can see it beginning with the telegraph, which is what you're talking about.
Yeah. And the tech body. Remember how the world became obsessed with Trump? He was expressing some demonic thing for many people. You know, he had hijacked the process.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazing. So, excellent.
Yeah.
So,
we should probably draw a line under it here, but this is obviously a very important part of your book.
Yeah.
And a very important topic in McLuhan and a very important topic in, you know, sort of where we're at.
Yeah, yeah. So that was, why did we get into Innes and you quoting that 46? How did we stumble from the Baudrillard to there? Oh, the eye ear. Oh, and then
that's
you
right.
Quoted Bulwer. And then that reminded me of the eye ear. Right.
The eye ear was already something that Innes said.
Yeah.
Right? When the stage was used to appeal to the eye rather than to the ear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. So we serendipitous did it again, created another incredible 2 hours of discovery, reinforcing how amazing Bob's book is.
It's certainly suggestive, put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. So excellent. Glad to have you notice this stuff.
Good. Well, thanks, Bob. I enjoyed the conversation, and I look forward to the next one.
Right. That was really good. Okay. Talk to you later, Cameron.
Okay. Ciao, Bob.
Bye.